Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And if you're one of our patrons, this is your extended, ad-free, higher-quality version of this week's show. And if you're not yet a patron but would like to get the aforementioned ad-free, extended, high-quality version of the show and listen and interact with us live, head to patreon.com/UK Tech. Get instant access as well to our entire back catalogue of extended shows. And thank you to Ross and Matt Dawson-Jones for joining us or for upgrading their pledges this week. It's fantastic to have you with us, or slightly more with us in the case of Matt, who moved up to our $5 tier. Thank you very much. Now, later on in the show, we're going to be joined by becoming a regular guest, Naomi Kerbel, and we'll come to why she is joining us at the point that she joins us, but that's in a few minutes. First, though, Ian, let's talk about the BBC, because it said that its podcasts are no longer available on certain Google products. So this includes the Google Podcast app and the Google Assistant. In a blog post, Kieran Clifton, who is the Director of BBC Distribution and Business Development, said this was because Google launched its own podcast app for Android users and has since begun to direct people who search for a BBC podcast into its own podcast service rather than BBC Sounds or other third-party services. Clifton said this reduces people's choice and is an approach that the BBC is not comfortable with. The blog went on to say that the BBC doesn't like removing its content from services and certainly doesn't do it lightly, but, quote, unfortunately, until Google changes the way they look at this, for the good of listeners, our podcasts will not be available on some of their services. Now, this doesn't prevent anyone from looking up the RSS feed URL of a BBC podcast and manually adding it into their podcast apps on Android. So it's not that the BBC is fundamentally blocking Android or Google users, but I have a deeper issue with this, Ian. It's what we're going to debate now. And it's around the BBC's really aggressive marketing of its Sounds app. Now, the BBC is pushing the service harder than I've seen it push even the iPlayer in recent years. And the Sounds app is essentially the iPlayer, but for radio and podcasts instead of TV and video. And if you listen to any BBC podcasts, you're very likely to hear hosts plugging the app. If you load the BBC News app as well on Apple News on iOS, you'll see a giant ad for BBC Sounds. And if you load any of the stories through that app, you'll also see a big fat promo for BBC Sounds embedded within those articles as well, and usually pretty high up. It's almost impossible, actually, to get away from it. And now the removal of podcasts from Google Podcast and Assistant is a direct result of the BBC not being happy that the Sounds app is not getting, you know, enough attention. And just before I let Ian actually say something, on the other side of the fence, I really want to point out, by no means against a company putting pressure on a giant international tech giant in an effort to prevent them from monopolizing a market. But the BBC is a bit different because it, A, has a duty under license fee rules to make its content available on popular platforms. And this particular issue, B, is worsened by the fact that podcasts are, by definition, and always should be, platform and device agnostic. It's an MP3 enclosed within an RSS feed, and anything that tries to shackle that, in my opinion, by means of paywalling or device blocking or other measures, whatever, risks turning the medium into a bit of a fragmented beast. And so I'm not happy with podcasts being the collateral in a fight between platforms. So, Ian, I need to stop saying words. Would you like to say some words?
Well, I do, but I'm also a little bit confused. I don't really understand what Google's thinking here is about why it is they would sort of direct people a different way. I mean, I'm thinking the example is, I want to find, say, the Kermode and Mayo film podcast. If I search in the Google podcasting app on my Android device, am I not going to find it through there at all? I'm going to have manually add it via an RSS feed.
As I understand it, that's correct.
Okay, but that was the BBC's decision to pull that. If they hadn't done it, what would I have found if I'd just searched Google? Surely they would have listed that podcast.
Well, I think the difference is that if you're on an Android device, and people can check this and correct us if we're wrong here, if you are on a Google device and you search Google for a podcast, the app, when you click on that podcast, it will open that in your Google Podcasts app. Yes. And that's a problem for the BBC because it wants people to open it in the BBC Sounds.
Yeah, but that doesn't make any sense. That's nonsense. I mean, that really doesn't ring true to me. And I completely understand what you're saying. And I know that the BBC's had some hassle about the Sounds app because it's obviously invested a lot of money into developing it. It wants it to be very popular. It's very targeted at the young audience, which they are struggling with, which is understandable because obviously the BBC does tend to skew a little bit older, as in general, because people are not consuming media in the old way that they used to. But I think that this definitely, like you said, sounds much more like a BBC decision, and I find that quite frustrating.
Well, it is entirely a BBC decision. You know, the BBC had said in this blog post that it had tried to talk to Google, it tried to get this worked out, but that, you know, whatever Google said was not, you know, coming.
But Google is presumably treating everyone the same. There is no, I mean, say if there was a text message app, we would not have any more luck getting them to launch that from the search than the BBC. So that's treating everyone the same, and then it's aggregating into one podcasting app. And there are other podcasting apps if you want to use one.
But the problem is that you have to sort of take a step back, actually, and look at the bigger problem faced by particularly large podcast networks, is that data from podcasting is exceptionally hard to get by nature of its design. You know, you have an RSS feed with an MP3 file you download. Now, there are so many issues with this as a way of distributing media, because, for example, does happen with me. You know, I use Overcast now as my main app. So there's Overcast on the web. I have Overcast the app on my iPad. I have the Overcast app on my iPhone. And they're all in sync.
Yes. So you can start on one and finish on another, and which is great.
Exactly. But on the iOS apps, I have them both set to automatically download new content. So I appear to
be three listeners or something.
To be three listeners, because all are from three different IP addresses and all are downloaded. Plus, making that worse, once you've got that device on your platform, you've got the download on your device, there's no way of the publisher of that episode knowing how far through did you listen. Did you download it once on one device and then listen to the other half of it on another device? There's no really good way of doing that unless you are using an app that provider either produced itself or has a deal with.
So the BBC Sounds app being the example that they can track everything across all your devices.
Exactly. So it doesn't matter then that you're listening on multiple platforms because they are the provider of that platform. Mm. And, you know, for full disclosure, you know, we are hosted through Acast. And if you listen on the Acast app, for example, you're still getting the same file as everybody else. But if you're listening within the app, then Acast knows who you are.
Yeah.
And
can track how far through each podcast you got.
Yeah. So it helps eliminate some of that duplication. And that's huge because for publishers like the BBC, obviously there's a huge commercial benefit to them knowing exactly how many listens they have, how engaged are they in listening, and it moves them away from having to rely on things like surveys and aggregate data and things.
And there is, of course, the argument that, in fact, Google is, and Apple also, are aggregating that data based on the information they have about people. So, for example, I still, for some reason, use the Apple Podcasts app, even though I find it quite frustrating. But presumably that means that Apple knows which podcasts I listen to, what I've made it through. And I'm assuming that they don't share that with the producers.
Actually, they do.
Oh, do they? So that, can you get some information?
Depending on how important you are, I'm pleased to say that in the past I have had access to this data, you do get limited demographic information. It's highly anonymized.
Well, you would expect so.
But it's things like, you know, it's your age range, it's where you're based, it's device type, things like that. And it helps you get a sense. What you don't get is things like, you know, how far through do people play? Yeah. Now, we do know that Apple wants to do more with podcasting in general, but we also know, and we're going to come to this a little later in the extended version of this show, about Apple's view on privacy of that data and not sharing it with providers. And so I actually don't expect that that some providers are going to get tons of useful data out of Apple.
No, and I don't think they should. I mean, like you said, privacy is such an important issue for Apple, and it is the one distinction that it makes over Google, for example.
And we also know, just to close things off here, we also know from a TechCrunch report that the BBC is in talks with other media companies to add their podcasts and live radio streams to the Sounds app. And that's a move that, you know, the BBC hopes is not just going to help the BBC itself, but also other media owners find some more competitive leverage against not only Google, but also Apple and Spotify. Again, this, according to TechCrunch, says that the latter two currently account for 80% of the podcast and music streaming market in the UK.
It's a shame that there isn't, no one has developed a standard for collecting data that was, you know, in the way that RSS is an open standard and allows, you know, people to easily get access to feeds of information. It's a shame that no one has generated a thing where, say, you embed a response URL in the podcast stream so that so each company could send some limited data back to the podcast owner, and that you could then maybe, you know, as we're on Acast, something like that. So Acast is then able to see some data based on that. I mean, but again, it's a hacked together system, isn't it? It's not designed to convey podcasts, really. It just happens that was the only way of doing it.
But it's all about balance. And at the end of the day, if you know how many downloads you're getting, if you have, say, I don't know, 10 million downloads a month, you know, which a popular podcast would possibly do, very popular podcast, 100, you know, 10 million downloads a month, or something like the Daily. I think the Daily gets, I want to say, 40 million downloads a month.
Wow.
I met a guy who works on it only a couple of days ago, and I think he said it's 40 million downloads a month. If you get that, but you know, but say, pretend that the Daily had a BBC Sound, was on a BBC Sounds type app, and you know that a million listeners are listening through that, and you get good data. Like, that's a fantastically large sample size to then extrapolate to the other 39 million people, and you can use that as a way of getting some good data. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing, but someone has to do something, and I do like the BBC's approach to building this as a new platform. I just don't necessarily like the aggressive way that it's pushing it, and it's using podcasts themselves as the collateral to do that.
Yeah, I agree, and it doesn't feel like a very BBC thing to do to me. I mean, the BBC is already in itself a massive producer of content, and it's easy for us to get kind of het up about this, and I have some sympathy for us in this regard, because, you know, you particularly work very hard to produce a podcast each week. Lots of effort goes into it, but we are all automatically at a disadvantage when you come to companies like NPR in the US, the BBC in the UK. These big companies or celebrities who launch podcasts and automatically have an audience of 10 million people or whatever. You know, it is always going to be harder for smaller people. So I suppose if the BBC could help with that, then that's good. But again,
I would love it. And this is the thing, like, I don't want to sound like I'm fundamentally against BBC Sounds. I'm fundamentally very much in favour of it.
Yeah.
What I'm just very against is this pulling of content, you know, for Android users and Google Podcast users, because I just feel that it's all a drive to push that app, and I don't think that's the right way to push that app.
But does Spotify give you any better data about listens?
It may do, but if it does, I haven't seen any.
Seen,
I mean,
it.
We're on Spotify, and, yeah, and, you know, people who want to listen to us through Spotify, they can. But even Spotify, those podcasts, they're delivered by RSS. It's the same MP3 file. The file is coming from Acast, in our case, and is going via RSS into Spotify, and that's how you listen to it.
Mm.
So again, the data is still coming from one source.
The only difference with Spotify being, of course, you can't add your own RSS feeds, which is crazy, but
you can. That's how we're in it.
Well, no, but what I mean by that is a listener can't decide that a podcast that isn't on Spotify, they can't add a podcast themselves.
I didn't know that.
Well, I mean, that's my assumption. I've never seen any functionality that would suggest it's possible.
Maybe somebody who's using Spotify for podcasts could tell us if this is possible, because I'm not 100% sure. But I mean, if Spotify wants to be a leader in podcasting, I would assume it either does let you do that or very soon would enable it. But well, we're going to wrap it up there. It's something that that touches Ian and I very deeply and passionately, this subject. But let us know any thoughts you have on this, experiences you have, thoughts on BBC Sounds and so forth. hello@techpodcast.uk. Thank you. Well, Gizmodo had a great write-up this week about the UK Office for National Statistics report that found 1.5 million of our nation's workers are at, quote, high risk of losing their jobs to automation. They quote, in 2017, out of the 19.9 million jobs analysed in England, 7.4% of people were employed in jobs at high risk of automation. Again, this is all according to the report. But women and part-time workers are most vulnerable, it said. Now, Gizmodo also noted that Unite, the UK's second largest trade union, took the opportunity to call for a shorter working week. Unite said a shorter working week without any loss of pay could help workers stay in work when new technology reduces the number of tasks that need to be done by people. Now, there's a lot of great context in Gizmodo's story, which was written by Brian Merchant, and we're going to link to that in the show notes and in the MP3 description in your podcatcher. Now, it's not new analysis to suggest automation is coming for many of our jobs, and many journalists are well aware that robots are already writing many of our news stories, but that tends to free us up, and I speak from personal experience here, to work on bigger, more important stories. So we're not going to cover that today. Instead, I wanted to focus on two issues that we've otherwise referenced. One, that automation could more seriously affect women, and that a shorter working week could be beneficial to anyone affected by the rise of AI. And to help us understand part of this issue, we're welcoming back a popular voice on the show, Naomi Kerbel, whose podcast Show Me the Way dives deeply into issues affecting women in a variety of professions, and she joined us a couple of weeks ago, and she's back now.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
My pleasure. So what stood out to you in this report regarding automation and women?
Well, it was interesting that it identified kind of waiters, waitresses, shelf fillers. I dove into the report from the ONS, and I noticed that the increase in risk of automation is particularly prevalent from the age of 35. Mm-hmm. And that's because of a change in working patterns. And I think that we can then go on a little later to talk about flex work. But that's because at that age, it's assumed that more women will start to work part time. Ultimately, it's the job itself that determines how at risk you are. I was looking a bit further into it, and there was a great article on Forbes written by one of the UK managers from LinkedIn, mm-hmm. a guy called Joshua Graff. And they did a study, a recent study over the last few days with the World Economic Forum, to try to quantify the global gender gap. They paid particular attention to the to AI and what I found on this. So what I was trying to see is, OK, so women are losing out. Mm-hmm. In these lower paid, lower skilled jobs, which they might go into part time, but also what can women then do to educate themselves to kind of learn more about AI to sort of fill those gaps? And I was a bit shocked to find out that only 22% of people with AI skills are women.
Right. So, and what counts as an AI skill in that regard?
Well, that's a good point. I didn't look into that.
I see. But I mean, AI, I mean, we're talking computer science. We're talking about, things that are broadly connected to STEM education. And we know that there's a shortage as well of skilled women in those fields, partly due to the fact that, you know, we're not necessarily making those jobs as attractive to women to be trained in the first place.
Yeah.
So I'd assume that was probably part of it.
Yeah, they were saying that of that 22%, there's a lot in academia, not so many are in software engineering. So that goes to your point.
Ah, exactly. I see, okay.
So if we kind of extrapolate that further, that means that the algorithms that will influence opportunities for men and women in the future are being built by one gender, mm-hmm. men, which raises the real concern that AI could embed a new kind of unconscious bias into the workplace, into those opportunities.
I see.
So it's even bigger an issue.
Yeah. And one of the things that you mentioned when I ran this past you earlier today was that because a lot of administrative jobs are currently held by women, and those sorts of administrative jobs, data entry, management, things that involves sitting at a computer and organizing a lot of stuff, that is something that automation and AI is known to be a big threat to. And so by default, since so many more women are doing those sorts of jobs, then they're going to lose out more so than men, simply because fewer men maybe are doing those kinds of jobs. I mean, in your head, how much of an issue is, I mean, obviously it's an issue, but how big of an issue in the grand scheme of things is that side of the argument, would you say?
I think I think that the administrative side is concerning. You know, as women, we are invariably we do those sorts of, we end up doing the kind of the scheduling, the admin. We go for roles that are seen to be slightly less involved, perhaps. So yeah, I think that that's probably it is a concern. The part time aspect of it, I think, is also an issue. Yeah.
But presumably, one solution would be to train women to do the role of programming the things that replace the jobs, right? So it would make sense for us to encourage our, you know, school age and university age girls to, you know, get involved in coding and stuff like that.
That's it. I always bring it back to the pipeline, and I liken it to sports. You know, we train up kids to, you know, training camps for football, for example, and you've got those children starting at 3, 4, 5. And if we were to do that with STEM subjects, really get kids involved in coding really early, then we are going to create that pipeline for the future, which is not gender, race, ethnicity specific, which is incredibly important.
And I think to your point as well, Ian, the fact that the first computer programmer was a woman.
Yep.
Ada Lovelace.
Good old Ada.
You know, is... I mean, it says a lot.
It does. And I mean, also, I'm faced with the ongoing issue as, you know, as you get older and especially in journalism where, you know, salaries are not necessarily good enough to sustain older people. I'm thinking from my perspective about how would I retrain. So it would be quite good to have like government support for people, you know, if there's people affected by, you know, job losses through automation, then, you know, can we make sure that there's training available for people so that they can become coders or, you know, learn how to operate the machines that, you know, I mean, I do think that I've had conversations with people who have said that automation often assists in jobs and doesn't always completely replace it. But there might be a big jump between being the person that does, say, data entry and learning how to, you know, fix the technology that does the automation. So really, I think it comes a lot down to perhaps making employers responsible for paying for retraining and stuff like that, but of course that doesn't address the specific gender inequality or the fact that NASA doesn't have enough spacesuits for women.
I mean, that's a parallel issue, isn't it? I mean, the fact is all of these issues need tackling.
Yeah.
And they all sort of feed into each other. But the other aspect that came out in this report, in the Gizmodo story, was the reference to the Unite group that suggested this shorter working week as being one of the possible side effects to the rise of automation. But it's something that's proposed as a way of offsetting the fact that a lot of roles are going to get automated. And I haven't been able to work out exactly how I feel about this, because on the one hand I'm wildly in favor of a shorter working week. On the other hand, I'm sort of against the thinking that if AI is taking up one day a week's worth of work, or is taking 20% of our tasks, if you like, why would we not then just want to put that 20% into a new type of responsibility? You know, I don't necessarily think that that's the reason to have a short week any more than just if you can have a short week and you want it, then do it. If that makes any sense. I mean, Naomi, would you think about, or Ian, even since, you know, Naomi and I work together. what do you think about a shorter working week?
I'm all for it, obviously, but people have bills, and I mean, it would be very difficult for most people to.
Yeah, I don't imagine the employer is going to pay you 100% of your salary to work.
No, but
80%
I mean,
of the time.
I am reminded of Bill Gates' suggestion that we tax the robots. And ultimately, I think the solution to all of our problems is to automate everything and have a universal basic income that enables people to do whatever they want. So, you know, some of us are doing jobs that we don't like very much, but we do them to earn a living. The idea being that a universal basic income would be, you know, taken from taxation. There wouldn't be benefits as such, but everyone would have a starting amount of money, and then they could do what they wanted to earn the rest of the money, but it would be much more possible to follow your passion. So Gates' idea was tax robots. So if you put a robot in a factory, then you have a prevailing tax rate, because obviously the employer is going to save money on not having a human. So by taxing each robot, you then generate an income for the government and stuff like that, and then people can have, and you can have a smaller starting salary, because you know, ultimately you wouldn't then need to earn quite as much. And there are tests about UBI, but I don't know how practical it is some countries are slightly better set up for it than the UK.
I mean, I have a great deal of respect for Bill Gates, as I believe most people probably should. He did also suggest that a way to combat spam was to charge for postage.
He did. I read that story, funnily enough. I read that story again because I was thinking about spam for some reason. No, because I'm always thinking about spam because I'm always getting it.
Yes.
And I did unearth that letter he wrote, because obviously Bill Gates is one of the ones that always gets targeted for. Bill Gates will give you $100 if you forward this email. So he'd written about this back years ago, and it is only available on the web archive, but it was, yes.
Yeah, also available in my mind.
Yes, but also, I mean, he's not wrong about that. Like, if there was a way to charge for email, like, it would probably cut down on spam.
Fundamentally, he's correct.
Yes.
But nobody's going to pay for email.
No.
Naomi, thank you very much for joining us. Do check out her podcast, Show Me the Way, which is available where all good podcasts are found. And Naomi, we'll have to have you back in the future to talk about more issues.
Thanks for having me.
Britain's chatbots are being abused, Ian. According to a BBC write-up this week, some of these automated chat helplines are being asked to send naked, nudie pictures of themselves and deal with some very fruity language indeed. On the one hand, it just serves as further evidence that if a human being is given tools to communicate with an entity, that person will inevitably end up asking for explicit images. We don't discriminate. We'll ask humans for nudes. We'll ask robots for nudes. The BBC wrote, though, that one financial chatbot had been asked out on a date nearly 2,000 times and to send nude pictures more than 1,000 times, according to its makers, Clio AI. The chatbot now responds to those sorts of requests by sending an image of a circuit board.
Very good.
It's good, isn't it? It's not only that, actually. If you ask it to make me a sandwich, it will send you pictures of sandwiches. If you say anything potentially homophobic, it will reply, "The complexities of human sexuality are rather beyond me at present," along with an emoji of a rainbow. Clio's lead writer, Harriet Smith-Hughes, told BBC News, quote, "The usual protocol is to rebut gendered abuse with gifts of strong, outspoken female figures. Meryl Streep, Star Trek's Captain Catherine Janeway," who is my favourite of all the captains in Star Trek, contrary to some popular consensus, but anyone who disagrees is wrong. Or Ripley and Alien, of course. And it also reminded me, Ian, of Microsoft's efforts a couple of years ago to create a simulated teenage AI chatbot called Tay. If you remember, it took less than 20... It took less than 24 hours for this little innocent entity to be corrupted. And there was a Verge write-up at the time that said, pretty soon after Tay launched, people started tweeting the bot with all sorts of misogynistic, racist and Donald Trumpist remarks. And Tay, being essentially a robot parrot with an internet connection, started repeating these sentiments back to users, proving correct the old programming adage, flaming garbage pile in, flaming garbage pile out. Ian, why can't we be trusted to treat AIs with respect?
Because we can't be trusted to treat anything with respect. We are a horrible species, and I think we are beyond redemption, frankly.
Okay, so we're struggling to treat each other with respect, so why are we surprised?
Well, that's exactly right. We are struggling to treat each other with respect, and I'm slightly more depressed by that than I am by the constant haranguing of chatbots, because they are ultimately code, and I don't think it has an impact on them psychologically. I mean, who knows in the future with a learning AI? There is an ethical debate to be had about, you know, at what point is an AI smart enough to be self-aware, and at that point, you know, we have to be very careful because we would be essentially creating a life form and then abusing it. I mean, I don't know how many years away we are from creating something that could actually be considered to be sentient, but it's probably not going to be in our lifetimes. So,
well, I'm reminded of the film Her.
Yes, I have seen it. Didn't enjoy it.
I really did enjoy it.
Did you?
It's bleak and it's very sad.
It's not a bleakness about it that bothers me. It just felt very odd.
For anyone who hasn't seen the film Her, it's a story about quite a lonely man dealing with a divorce who ends up falling in love with a fully sentient AI woman, and you know, go to all lengths to replicate human relationships, you know, both sexual and emotional and everything else, even, you know, assisting with day-to-day stuff.
I mean, obviously humans are I suppose for reasons of survival very likely to form relationships with things and people, you know, and that's probably one of the better things about humanity. Like, we, you know, we are driven to collect together in groups and, you know, spend time together and, you know, fall in love and et cetera, et cetera. And I don't necessarily want to cast judgment on people who do have feelings towards artificial intelligence. It feels a bit odd to me, but then I'm, you know, Siri doesn't provide me with enough information to get a crush.
Well, you know, a friend of the show, sometimes co-host, also my brother Andy Hoyle of CNET.
Yes.
One of the first videos he ever did for CNET was him taking Siri out on a date, which I think is still online, probably on CNET or YouTube. Yeah. If you want to look it up, Andy Hoyle Siri date will probably bring it up. He looks so youthful. Oh, and it was also a very old, you know, it's the initial version of Siri, and I assume she's developed more in her romantic capabilities since then, but I have not tested it.
No, and me neither, and I don't have any desire to. But again, I was thinking about this the other day, actually. I was thinking about, you know, as we age, you know, we inevitably our thoughts turn to what we're going to do in, you know, our later years. Mm. And I was thinking about how little I enjoy spending, you know, time alone. I mean, sometimes I like to be alone, but sometimes I don't. And I was thinking, you know, what happens if you're forced into a situation where you are alone? And could, you know, future versions of Alexa and Siri, I've said some real words there that are going to annoy people, but could they help people feel less lonely?
And I think there are actually some very good studies out there that yes, the answer is yes, particularly with the elderly. We've seen this with robotic home assistants in Japan. It's being used partly to combat the issues raised with an aging population. Mm. But there are definitely studies out there that have shown that sort of a technology can have a positive effect on people dealing with the, you know, the effects of loneliness or
well, and the same with pets, right? I mean, we transpose a lot of human qualities on animals that are completely irrelevant. I talk, you know, I suppose I shouldn't do it, but my daughter was trying to, the cat had bitten her, but not hard, but a warning nip, you know, in the way that they do. Mm. And she was still cross about it, and she was like, I'm not letting the cat in unless he apologizes to me. And I'm like, Izzy, he does not understand the concept of an apology or how he treating you was in anything other than completely normal for him. He, you know, cats will defend, especially if you go for the belly, they will always defend themselves because they're very aware that their underside is very susceptible, as they're quite delicate on the underneath. And, you know, so he's just doing what he's programmed to do, if you like. But it's quite difficult to explain to people that their cat is not a person and that, you know.
Well, some people, for example, me, just don't like to hear it because when I'm home alone and my wife's at work and, yes, she's taking the dog out and it's just Robin and I in the house, as you know well, I enjoy nothing more than singing to the cat about his various parts.
Yes.
And I like to believe that not only does he hear me, but he appreciates
it. Oh, he hears you. And he just doesn't have any comprehension of what it is you're doing. It's as unclear to him as it is to you when he meows.
You know how I was talking about how we inevitably end up talking sort of sexualizing AI, and it's just human nature to be abusive to other people.
Yes.
It is also inevitable that at some point in every podcast we are going to end up talking about our cats.
Yes. Yes, I'm all for it, though.
It's a good point to end. Anyone listening, do feel free to let us know your views on the aforementioned hello@techpodcast.uk. Fun question, what do you sing to your cat? Feel free to furnish us with an MP3 recording to play on next week's show.
You're used to hearing the smooth, velvet sound of Nate's voice drizzled over your ears like a warm eardrum syrup, topped off with the freshly squeezed citrus tang of an Ian Morris opinion. Supporters of the show at patreon.com/UK Tech enjoy second helpings every week. So pull up a chair, find your nearest spoon, and tuck into a sumptuous extra helping with no commitment. If you have any allergies, please inform a waiter.
We had some messages from listeners this week, but one I just wanted to pick out was from Lewis, who wrote in to comment on my confusion over the term pie being used to mean a pizza, which I'd never heard, much less still understand. Lewis says, pie is just generic slang for a pizza of any kind. It's not a specific style, nor is it any different from your usual pizza, as a round, usually flat dough with toppings, sauce and cheese baked in a high-temperature oven. Some people, not me, also use, well, he's written czar, which was recently added to the Scrabble dictionary, at least the US one, he says. Now, that's...
Well, now you're a two-letter Scrabble king, aren't you?
So... Yes, and you can have zo. Z-O
right, okay.
Is czar. Okay, good. Well, I'm gonna look that up because I didn't know that was a word. I actually wondered whether he was done a typo and it meant to be a different word, because my spell check in our show notes is saying it isn't a word. But either way, pie means any type of pizza. I didn't know this.
There is also a czar restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is pizza.
Oh!
Google.
I mean, this is what you listen to, ladies and gentlemen. You hear the latest tech insights, you hear that I sing to my cat, and you hear what we call pizzas.
Shall, do you want the Urban Dictionary definition?
Not really.
Okay.
But go on, some people might.
Really obnoxious word for pizza, and no self-respecting person uses it.
Oh, okay.
But I guess it's the end of pizza.
Well, it's choice.
Zuh.
Zuh. Oh,
probably
I see.
How you'd say it, I guess.
Fascinating. Well, the text message keeps you informed about the British slang landscape and songs we sing to our domesticated quadrupeds. But let's check in with our friends at Daily Tech News Show in the US and hear what's been happening in the wider world of actual technology this week.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, we dug into Apple News Plus as being the most immediately relevant of Apple's service announcements, but we also speculate on why they announce so much TV stuff with so little substance like dates or details. We think it might have to do with attracting other partners. We also talk about a vase you can throw to put out fires, that's right, and a detailed look at that damning Huawei report from the UK, which I interpret as you get what you pay for. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, of course, to Naomi Kerbel of the Show Me The Way podcast for appearing earlier in voice form. Although I can confirm she was also in physical form. She is not a disembodied insight generator. Thank you, of course, most of all to our patrons. I'm getting a phone call. Let me just cancel this. There we go. Thank you also, of course, even more so to our patrons for supporting us every week. If you're not yet a patron but would like to get our ad-free, extended, higher quality versions of each week's show, plus listen to us live most weeks, head to patreon.com/UK tech and help us finish the month with one more patron than we had last month. And I should point out, look out in your feed a little later on this week, maybe in the next couple of days, we put a public post up about some changes to our Patreon tiers system. That's available now, and you can find it on the Twitter at Text Message Pod if you want to read it. But we're going to do an audible version of that as well, just so everyone is aware of what's coming. That'll just be a regular little MP3 in your feed later on this week.
Right, and Nate and I love to hear from everybody, and we read every email. So send comments to hello@techpodcast.uk. Follow us on Twitter at Text Message Pod to keep up to date with the most important UK technology headlines throughout the week. And thanks to everyone listening to us on our free ad-supported feed. If you've got a minute to leave a review for us on iTunes, it's the best way of supporting us without spending a penny.
Certainly is. And now, without further ado, I'm off for a sausage.
Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.